what I came to realize in my life is there is pain that I choose all the time. When I go to the gym, I choose pain. When someone chooses to climb a mountain, they're choosing pain. When I choose to write a book, I'm choosing pain.
Yeah, I know that, like, pain, yeah.
That's all pain I'm choosing, and I'm choosing it because it gives me a specific benefit.
Yeah.
I would argue that I've gotten just as much benefit from the pain I didn't choose in my life as I have from the pain I've chosen in my life. In fact, I would argue that I've gotten more benefit from the pain I didn't choose in my life than from the pain I chose.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today, I think, is going to be a very anticipated event. For the first time, I have Matthew Hussey on the podcast. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. This is fun. I get to do it in our space, which is really nice.
Does it feel like kind of weird that you're being interviewed in your own space?
No, it feels weirdly comforting.
Good.
I feel very at home. If I feel like, yeah, you know, I get nervous when I go on daytime TV or do like a live show. I feel like if it happened in my living room, I'd feel
You'd be a lot better.
Yeah, I'd be a lot
like
better.
In front of your actual audience.
I'd be more myself.
Well, I'm so excited to have you on. I mean, I was saying to you before we hit record that, like, there couldn't be a more curated audience to hear from Matthew Hussey. And your reputation for sure precedes you, because how long have you been doing this now? Like, speaking about relationships, teaching about human connection?
17 years.
Right. And I was saying to you before, too, like, an original. Like, you're an OG of the space. Really.
Which is so funny to me, because I used to always feel like the young pup in the room.
Yeah.
Like, I my whole life, I felt like the underdog, kind of almost having to answer for why I was there.
Right.
And I always remember people used to say to me, like, so how do you know this so young? And then at a certain point, without me really realizing it consciously, people stopped asking that question.
That's and when I you realized, know when you've
I went,
aged.
Oh, I got older. Yeah.
So, how did you, like, when you were first beginning, I'm really curious about that, because I'm sure people were like, you're not old enough to know.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in a relationship? Right. Like, all the questions. I got a lot of those questions.
Sure.
When I
yeah.
started. Yeah.
I think it's such a weird paradox, because I was being asked those questions about, like, so how do you know all this? Where does this come from? Or, you know, people trying to work out, like, what, where's this stuff you're saying coming from? It doesn't feel like you should have had enough life experience to be able to say these things. And it's the truth, I feel like, lied somewhere in between me being good at doing what I was doing and also them being right that I wasn't quite ready. You know what I mean? It was like it was both, because you know, sometimes you say things that are really great and they're really true and they're really helping a lot of people, and you haven't quite grown into them yet. You know, there's like a pair of shoes it's a good pair of shoes, but they don't fit you yet. And it's going to take some time for them to actually fit you. And I feel like I've spent many years growing into a pair of shoes that I was sporting before I was ready for them. And that comes with some real challenges. You know, I think someone asked me recently what would I go back and tell my 19-year-old self.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was I started making videos when I was 19 years old, and I kind of wish that I would be able to tell that guy, like, your intentions and your heart and your ability to, like, the way you show up for people in itself is really healing.
Mm-hmm.
So just keep, like, doing that, but don't feel like you need to know everything yet. You know, you can take time to learn that stuff. People will forgive you that, because your energy that you bring is really powerful. So just keep bringing that energy and worry less about knowing the answers to everything.
Did you feel like there was a lot of pressure to know it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because you're teaching it.
I just think the same. There was someone in my life that used to say, when he was young, you'd be saying something and he'd go, yeah, I know. And at one point in our relationship, I said to him, I want to just give you a piece of advice. You could take it or leave it, but just don't keep saying I know when someone's telling you something, because the most fun part of telling someone something is that they're either surprised or they ask you more about it, or there's a curiosity when someone, when you're saying something and someone before you've even finished speaking says, yeah, I know. And I know. It's like, it's this takes the fun out of every, you know, like people will want to teach you things if you don't continuously say, I know. And by the way, you can't know, you can't know everything that you don't know. And so it's not that in my own life I wasn't intensely curious, because I was, but I think you put yourself in a bit of a cage sometimes when you put yourself in a prison when you start doling out advice at scale, you know, you,
especially at the scale that you hit.
Exactly. It might have been different maybe if I had started at 35 and then, you know.
Yeah, that's when I started.
Right. So, and I think that's a safer place to start from, because you have a sense of who you are. And, you know, I think it's safer for all forms of success.
Relationally, everything, right?
Yeah, but yeah. I think I started at a time where it wasn't great for me, because it forced me to think that I had to be a certain way at an age where I should have been intensely just in discovery and growth mode. More play, more freedom to screw up, more freedom to acknowledge where I was going wrong or what I was struggling with. And I think a lot of my struggles took place just in a very private room in my life, and it tends not to be good, because you isolate yourself. And I was very lucky. I have, you know, my family's so loving, and I have amazing friends. I've never surrounded myself with people who just agree with me, or, you know, it's everyone in my life who I've kept close have always been intensely authentic people. So that saved me. But I definitely wish I'd given myself more space to be, you know, every facet of myself with people out there. And by the way, I wasn't actually giving my audience and the people that liked my work enough credit, because there was some part of me that definitely felt like, you know, I would turn people off, or I wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't want to hear from me anymore if I had that problem, or if I'd made that mistake, or if, and what was happening on a macro level, I think, was also being mirrored in my private life, where in my relationships, I don't think I entirely realized how not vulnerable I was being. I thought I was being vulnerable. You know, like, if you'd have asked me, I would have said, no, I'm vulnerable. But I really wasn't in so many ways. I realize that now. You know, I the way that I'm vulnerable today, and the way that I am, I feel so much more comfortable today. And it's still a journey. I'm still trying to get more comfortable with myself all the time, you know. But I didn't realize the extent to which I was afraid to speak things then, for fear of not being seen as the heroic version of myself. I think we live in a world today where there's so many like hero's journey stories that are told.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like everyone's Joseph Campbelling it. Like, here's where I was, and when I was destitute and broke and loveless and hated my, and that was, you know, it's always like 10 years ago. It's never last year.
Right.
Right. It's always far enough away that I can really
distance.
I'm not
in it ever again.
And then it's a hero's journey to where I am today. And it's not that those stories aren't, you know, people have those stories. I'm not minimizing them, but the real stories are so much more complex, and they're also not vulnerable stories, right? The story of how I was really struggling and now I'm great is not a story of vulnerability. It's a story of how awesome we are.
Look what I've done.
What I came out of. And I realized, you know, there was too much of that playing a role in not just my professional life, but too much of that playing a role in my private life as well, where, you know, if I was dating someone or in a relationship, I think I, more than I ever realized, would play the heroic version of myself. And there were always things that I just didn't say because I was too afraid that, you know, it would change someone's perception of me, or, you know, there was no going back from that once you'd seen that part of me. And once you'd seen that part of me, that, that would make me unlovable, which is something that's been corrected for me in my relationship with my wife.
Yeah, it certainly would be hard if the brand or the work that we're doing communicates a high level of competence, and then internally we're having a hard time with something. Because I would imagine, I mean, this has happened to me too, that people project a sort of idea from what they've listened to or read. And I made this assumption for people, which wasn't fair, was that I wouldn't want to expose my humanness. Like in some way it would like, it would bring me down from this perception they have of me, which is exactly what is required to humanize an experience, for someone to see their possibility in you. And I couldn't imagine starting to talk about relationships at 19, because I was in the middle of my own self-destructions and I experienced betrayal. And, you know, I was picking up the pieces, trying to figure it out through one night stands. And, you know, and it wasn't until my late 20s that I started to look at these types of things. But my work became this way that I held myself accountable to the integrity of what I was teaching. But it became a prison too, because then when I have a relationship in, I'm like, well, how do I teach anymore? Do you know what I mean? Like, I'd want to hide those types of things. And I'm, when I think, when I think about the evolution of your work, I was listening to a podcast that you were on where you were talking about competence versus confidence. Mm-hmm. And it really feels like so much of the evolution of your work is from the like skill set perspective, which is of course important, to like the embodiment. And so I'm curious if you could tease that out, because I thought it was really, for people to hear, just such a great perspective.
Yeah, God, I think that's, I think you're right about that. I think what helped me was that early on, I don't think that I was saying anything it's almost like I wasn't playing in hugely deep waters with the things I was saying very early on, because it was more like helping people create opportunities, helping people put themselves out there differently. It, you know, the things that I was talking about were things that I myself had managed to do. I grew up as a very shy, introverted kid who, I'm still introverted, I'm a little less shy, but when I, you know, I struggled to be like, put myself out there. And so when I started helping other people, I was like, well, I've managed to find some tools and some ways to be more brave and to create more opportunity for myself. And I was sharing those things that had already worked for me. But, you know, over time, of course, you do end up getting into deeper waters, because you end up talking to people about deeper things going on with them. And, you know, for me, for example, I would learn, I had this kind of somewhat naive theory when I first started out that people would make better choices in their love life if they had more choice in the first place. You know, if they had more options, they would make better choices. They wouldn't choose the person who was abusive. They wouldn't choose the person who was disinterested, and I was right that people felt more empowered when they were able to create choice, which is what I was showing them back then. But I was wrong that people would make better choices.
Yeah, right.
And that led me naturally into deeper waters, because of course you then have to ask the question, why is it that we keep making the same choices even when better choices present themselves? And, you know, I think in terms of me embodying confidence in a different way, I think I had to, one of the really sobering things for me was going, why am I not happy? Like, what is, something's wrong. Like, I remember having this distinct feeling around 27. I remember thinking, I'm not happy. I don't feel good. I'm running. I could feel myself, things were going well, and there was an ungodly amount of views on my videos, and I was getting, I was on TV a lot, and I was running a big team, and I was just like, just felt like my life, as soon as like the day ended, I was trying to escape somehow. And then, you know, that inevitably translated to my love life as well, because I couldn't, I was like, well, I am able to create opportunity, but I don't feel happy. Why do I not feel happy? I certainly wasn't capable of making anyone else happy, because I couldn't figure out how to be content myself. Mm-hmm. I was either in relationships where I was, you know, questioning whether it was the right relationship for me, and living in a constant state of self-doubt, and or I was single and on this dopaminergic roller coaster of chasing highs and, you know, thrills and romance, and all of it just left me feeling a little bit a bit scared, because I just thought, God, I don't know how to be happy in this area. Like I would see friends who didn't seem to struggle with the same things I did. They were in relationships and they didn't spend every day wondering if it was the right relationship, and they just seemed to have figured it out. Mm-hmm. And that was tough for me, because I had the same questions other people do. Is it just that I haven't met the right person yet?
Right.
Is it, you know, is someone going to come along and make me feel the way that I'm supposed to feel? Is it me? Am I broken? Am I someone who, I remember having the thought where I was like, am I just, you know, am I just never satisfied? I ended up dedicating a chapter in the book, in the new book, to that very concept. I called it Never Satisfied. And there's a moment in the show Hamilton that like I pulled out for the book, because it, you know, there's a moment where I think it's Angelica meets Alexander, and he says, you're like me, I'm never satisfied. And it's like two people who struggle to find satisfaction finding each other, and how dangerous that is. I felt like that, you know? So, yeah. That for me, the embodiment was I would say there were two big things that I felt like I had to figure out. One was how to accept myself on a level that I never had before.
Yeah.
Because I think I carried around a lot of things deeper down that I thought made me unlovable, or made me, you know, just shame or regret or guilt, or, and, you know, I don't think I ever trusted anyone to truly love that me. Mm-hmm. And the second thing was me learning how to start chasing, and I mean chasing in a positive sense, but how to start chasing a different kind of feeling than the one that I had been chasing so far. That there was this recognition that whatever I'm doing right now is jacking up my nervous system constantly in ways that are leaving me feeling, yes, I'm getting some highs, but I am like anxious and unhappy and this doesn't feel good. And I was like, there's some other thing that I have to orient myself towards, some other feeling, peace for one, or this isn't going to end well, you know?
What was the turning point for that? Like, where was the, I'm done with this and I'm actually ready to finally turn towards this, you know, deeper path? And, you know, to me, it sounds like you've been writing this book for a long time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe literally, but also.
Literally. Well, that's it, even that, you know, literally for, you know, 4 or 5 years of my life. And, but certainly long before that, in terms of what I was starting to edge towards, you know, in terms of the turning point, my wife will tell you, when she met me, she was like, the word she uses is searching. She was like, I could feel, my wife's like the most compassionate, empathetic person. She feels people. Like, she just gets people.
She like saw right in.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. You know, and she was like, you were not when I met you, like you were, I could feel you were like searching for something. You didn't know what it was, but like you were searching for something. And I think I'd been doing that for a couple of years, because I'd hit some pretty like, I'd had some rough times that people didn't know about. You know, I'd been through a bad heartbreak. I had developed years before that one of the things that had plagued me for 7 years of my life, maybe four or five by that point, was chronic physical pain. And I never spoke about it because it was too, it was like, it was, it put me on the edge. Like I really was not, I was functional in my life, but like a zombie is functional.
Wow.
I got tinnitus where my ears wouldn't stop ringing. And then on top of that, I had all sorts of physical pain in my ear and my head that just didn't go away, to the extent that I went to every kind of treatment, therapy, both physical, psychological. I mean, I did so much. I flew to different parts of the world to try and fix it. I listened to anyone on anything who could throw me a lifeline and try this, try that. And, and nothing worked. And it really put me in a dark, dark place where I didn't know what, it was the darkest time in my life for sure. Cause I didn't know what to, I didn't know how to get out.
Yeah.
And I thought, if I can't fix this physical pain, I'm never going to be happy again. And I remember the reason I started therapy was because I was in such a dark place that I thought, I honestly don't know what I'm going to do. I need saving here. And I remember going to a therapist and saying to him, I have decided that I am just going to live for everyone else from now on.
Wow.
Like I love my family. I love the people that work with me in the company. I get to help people in life as a living. I'm just going to pour energy outward and try and live for other people, because my life is over. If I can't get rid of this pain, I'm never going to be happy, because it's all I think about. And I don't know how to get rid of this pain.
Yeah.
So where does that leave me?
Right.
And so that those things were a huge catalyst for me, because it, my whole life had been very type A, very driven, knew how to like work my way out of a bad situation. And like for the first time in my life, there was a situation, there was no, I couldn't work my way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't outsmart it. I couldn't run away from it. I couldn't do anything. I just had to figure out how to navigate my relationship with it. And that was the biggest learning. It was a very humbling thing, in some ways too humbling, because it fed into my, like it started to affect the way I saw my value in the world. Like I remember thinking, I write about it in the book, like no one's ever going to be attracted to me again, because they don't, even if they think I'm attractive, when they get to know me, they're going to see how fragile I feel.
Yeah.
And this is like the opposite of the, like, you know, strong man who's able to, like, I feel like I'm going to fall apart in any moment because of how on the edge I am with this pain all the time. And it made me feel really weak. So I just in every way was in a dark place, and navigating my relationship with that became like a completely new path in my life that I never would have taken. I think I would have kept on some level
doing what you're doing,
just covering, you know, whatever ways I wasn't accepting myself or whatever. I would have just kept covering over it with the next achievement and the next thing that I do and whatever. And this just forced me to figure out how to find some form of peace and happiness, even in a time when everything felt like it was going wrong. So, yeah.
How did you, like, what did that look like to go from, you know, it sounds like all of a sudden an external focus, right? Like I'm going to live for everybody else, which is more like I'm going to put other people, like that's the priority. That's the thing that's keeping me here.
Yeah.
Which can be not a bad thing when we're considering not being here.
Yeah.
It like might be the bridge, but that really what's being asked is like a desperate internal focus.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. The truth is I didn't know what that looked like.
Yeah.
Like what, yeah, I didn't at the time know what that even meant. Even like sitting there and, you know, meditating. Mm-hmm. Aside from the pain I was feeling, it just, my ears would ring.
Yeah.
And it would like just take me straight back to the way I was feeling all the time. And it was like meditation was maddening for me at the time. And I started to, like one by one, I started to, I would talk to everyone. I would try and ask for advice everywhere I went. And I would just glean like a tool here, like just pulling in anything that kind of worked. And I had a lot of wisdom along the way and a lot of help in different ways. And I, you know, the final chapter of this book, I call Happy Enough, because I believe, even though this is a book that's designed to be a co-pilot for anyone who's looking for love, who mm-hmm. wants to find their person, what I recognized is that you have to find a way. Happy intimidated me. When I was in my worst times, happy was so far away.
Yeah.
That it was like someone telling me to learn how to be happy made me want to punch them in the face.
Totally, I get that.
So I was like, happy can't be my goal right now. I need to learn to be happy enough that I can come back to my life. And so everything I did was about finding the tools to be happy enough. And the reason I put them in the last chapter of the book is because everything I learned about managing my chronic physical pain is equally applicable to chronic emotional pain. Because for me, they became one and the same.
Right.
Right. And I had a woman come to me and say, this wasn't even that long ago, but I had a woman come to me and say, bear in mind, a lot of people will come to me with some version of a question that centers around how to find love.
Yeah.
She said to me, how do I kill my desire to find love? She said, I have spent my whole life dreaming of finding my person. And I had one relationship that wasn't even a very good one. And even then I felt like at least I had something, and that ended, years ago now. Since then, I've never met anyone again. She said, when I see friends who are in relationships, I'm happy for them. And at the same time, it hurts so much because it's just a constant reminder of what I don't have. And she said, if I hold on to this desire to meet someone and I never do, I'm going to be sad for the rest of my life. So can you help me kill that desire?
Wow.
The funny thing is, it's like, as heartbreaking and as tragic a question as that sounds, that is how I felt
right.
with my physical pain. It's like I saw, when she said that to me, I saw myself sitting in front of a therapist going, you know, I'm, as long as this pain is here, I'm never going to enjoy life again. My life is over. So the tools that I started to use, I pulled from everywhere. I had a coach say to me, you know, I remember one of the side effects of, you know, my physical pain was that there were certain foods and things that really like took it from an 8 to a 9 or a 10. And you know, any form, and a drop of alcohol, not like 3 beers, like a drop of alcohol seemed to like just send it going haywire, and my head would hurt and I'd feel rough and I'd feel my ear would start ringing and pain in my ear, and certain foods would do it, and it was like all my favorite things, like it was like everything. Yeah, yeah.
It's
I
never
loved.
Like Brussels sprouts.
No. And I remember saying to this coach, I can't even, like, one of the few things that I could still kind of enjoy was like eating my feelings or, you know, like
yeah, you can't
having
even do
a
that.
Drink or whatever. Yeah. And she and I was like, I can't even like, I love food. Like, I'm, you know, I love travel. I love food. I associate food with so many positive experiences in my life. I love trying new foods. I love all of it. And it felt like, here is another thing this thing has taken from me. Like my, the ringing in my ears has always taken has already taken silence from me. I used to love silence. Now I hate yeah. silence. Now it's food and alcohol. And I was never a big drinker, but I love food. I love experiencing things in life. Yeah. And she said to me, listen, we don't know how this is going to affect you 5 years from now. We don't even know how this is all going to affect you a year from now. So let's lose the ceremony of I can never have another drop of wine, or I can never eat another cheeseburger. I can never, yeah. like, let's lose the ceremony and just focus on the facts. Right now, these things seem to agitate your symptoms. So for now, let's not do some of these things. But also recognize that everything changes. So let's just pause them for now, see if this gets better, and then we'll reevaluate. And that idea of lose the ceremony was really, really powerful for me, because I realized there is a pattern in my life that's showing up here of endless catastrophic thinking that is proving to be really unhelpful with this particular thing. Because I'm telling myself a story that my life is over, that it's never going to get better, that I'm never going to enjoy anything again, that I'm unlovable, that I'm weak, that I'm like, there's so much story to this. What the big realization I had is there's my physical pain that is very real to me, but then there is the relationship that I have with this pain emotionally. And I don't seem to have any control right now over this one, over the physical pain, but I have a lot of control over my relationship with this pain. And if the emotional component is 50% of it, even if it's 40% of it, then me changing the emotional component of this can have a profound impact on, if that can take the pain from an 8 to a 5, then that that might get me to happy enough. And happy enough is where I might start making an impact in my life again. Happy enough might be where I start to bring back a bit of my playfulness, because I'd lost so much of my playfulness in that time. You know, happy enough might make me strong again. So I started to pick up on all of those things. I had one thing that helped me was this idea of choosing your pain. So Guy Winch, a psychologist, told me of an experiment with two rats, rat A and rat B. And rat A was on a wheel and it got to run whenever it wanted on this wheel. Rat B was on a wheel, but rat B's wheel was hooked up to rat A's wheel. So whenever rat A ran, rat B had to run. Now, both rats were doing the same amount of exercise.
Yeah.
But at the end of the experiment, rat A showed all of the positive markers of exercise, and rat B showed all of the negative markers of stress.
That's super interesting.
Same amount of exercise.
Yeah.
But one was choosing to run.
Yeah.
And the other one was made to run. And hearing that story made me realize, oh, I am so unhappy because in my mind, I am rat B. I am being made to run this race that I didn't choose. I'm being made to deal with this pain that I don't want. I am a victim of all of this. And what I came to realize in my life is there is pain that I choose all the time. When I go to the gym,
right,
I choose pain. When someone chooses to climb a mountain, they're choosing pain. When I choose to write a book, I'm choosing pain.
Yeah, I know that, like, pain, yeah.
Yeah, that's all pain I'm choosing, and I'm choosing it because it gives me a specific benefit.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I would argue that I've gotten just as much benefit from the pain I didn't choose in my life as I have from the pain I've chosen in my life. In fact, I would argue that I've gotten more benefit from the pain I didn't choose in my life than from the pain I chose.
Why do you think there's a different, like, what's the differentiation?
Because I think almost spiritually, I have gotten more pain from the things I've had to surrender to in some way.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Than the things I volunteered for.
Yeah.
The physical pain in my life that I had to overcome, it was a surrendering mission that I'd never had to do before. And, but what I would start to see with the difficult circumstances of my life is that almost like they were on a menu. Like there's this pain menu, and next to each item are the unique benefits that you get from that item on the menu. And I would start seeing those benefits and being like, those are really great. Like, I actually want those.
Yeah.
Like, these are actually very unique, very special benefits that I want in my life.
Yeah.
So I would almost see myself retroactively choosing the difficult circumstance to get the benefit of those items on the menu.
Yeah, knowing what you're going
to... Knowing what I'm going to get, what I am getting, who I'm having to become to deal with this. And by doing that, it started to actually move me from being rat A or rat B to rat A.
Mm, from like victim to now...
Now I'm choosing to run on this wheel because it's giving me a benefit.
Yeah.
And it's not just some story I told myself. Like, it's really real. Like, I am who I am today with the ability that I have today because of this intensely humbling and intensely difficult personal experience of mine, which took place in private. I never talked about it while it was happening for 7-8 years of my life. I never talked about it publicly.
Did you want to?
No, because I was so... My worst nightmare at the time was mentioning it to people. And then it was the one thing in my life I, with all my might, tried to forget about, tried to not pay attention to. Like, my whole life was a mission in not focusing on this thing.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea that I would tell thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of people about this thing, and that then people would be messaging me saying, have you tried this? Have you tried that? Yeah, are your ears still ringing? Yeah. Is your head still hurting? Yeah. Is that genuinely was like a form of hell on earth to me to think about that. So I was like, I'm telling no one about this. So the only people that knew were my close family and friends. Yeah.
Fun fact, saunas were originally regarded as holy spaces. I didn't know that. A place to heal and cleanse both the body and the soul. Originating from Finland, saunas were actually first used as a covered cave where families would keep warm together and stay safe in winter. Now, due to the significance of saunas as a holy place for a family, profound life moments like births, marriages, and funerals would occur there. In other words, it was a place where loved ones gathered, connected, and healed together. I love thinking about the history of this now when I use my infrared sauna blanket from Bon Charge. The ancient roots of this ritual, the healing, the cleansing of the body and the soul, and the way it naturally connects me deeper with my loved ones as I find myself revitalized, de-stressed, and open after a session in the blanket. My wife and I actually take turns at night playing with our son while the other one gets a session in the blanket. What a gift to carry on this tradition, right? And to get to do it from the comfort of my own home and really bringing this sacred practice in both the place I live and through the time I carve out in my infrared sauna blanket. And I love weaving the history with modern day technology. The infrared sauna blanket is low EMF and works by using infrared light, which heats the body directly rather than air around you like a traditional sauna. This means you get the same benefits at a lower heat temperature. It also offers ease in both setup and storage with its sleek and lightweight design. So join me in bringing this ancient and healing tradition into your day-to-day. Go to bondcharge.com/markgroves and use the coupon code MARKGROVES to save 15%. That's bondcharge.com/markgroves and use the code MARKGROVES to save 15%. As we embrace the freshness of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, I'm feeling the need for an energetic reset. And what better way to support this renewed energy with a daily nutrient-dense ritual? Let me introduce you to Organifi's Sunrise to Sunset Kit, a three-step transformation for your entire day. Organifi has curated a kit that covers all your bases. A detoxifying morning reset, an afternoon energy boost, and a nighttime relaxation tea. All packed with superfoods that your body will absolutely love. Our bodies naturally follow in a cortisol rhythm, high in the morning and low in the evening. But with the increased stressors in modern lifestyles and sometimes too much caffeine, this rhythm can easily get disrupted, leading to unstable energy levels. That's where Organifi steps in. They've included adaptogens like ashwagandha in the morning green juice reset to create balanced energy throughout the day. And for that afternoon pick-me-up, their red juice is full of antioxidants and adaptogens such as cordyceps and rhodiola to provide natural and sustained energy, all without the need for excessive caffeine. And when it's time to wind down, sipping on gold after a meal or before bed helps transition your body from a stress state to a rest and relaxed state. It's good tasting and good for you. So if you're ready to step into a new season with a boost of energy and overall balance, you can't go wrong with Organifi's Sunrise to Sunset Kit. Use the code CREATETHELOVE for 20% off this kit and all of Organifi's other amazing products at Organifi.com/createthelove.
What did you, like, when you think about the question that woman asked you, like, how do I kill this desire?
Yeah.
What did you garner from your experience? And I'd love to hear, like, the resolution of that through the looking through what you'd been through. How did you answer her?
The thing that really helped her in that session I did with her was explaining that there is, you know, taking a common moment, like you're in bed at night and you get that pang of loneliness and the longing. That there's the sensation of that, and then there's the relationship you have with that sensation. The same way that I have the pain, oh, my head and my ear are hurting, and now I have the relationship I have with my head and my ear hurting. What domino, when you feel that, what domino gets pushed? And what are all the dominoes that start falling as a result of that? And what I said to her was, there's a physical sensation to what you're feeling, right? When you feel lonely, it's like you feel it somewhere. Maybe you feel it in your stomach or your chest or your throat, but there's a feeling. The first thing is just to acknowledge that, oh, this is a physical sensation I'm feeling right now. And before all of the story finds its way in, because that's attached itself to a story.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm still on my own at this point in my life. I'm not good enough for anyone to love me. I'm never going to find anyone. I'm going to die alone. I'm gonna, like, there's all this story that creeps through the door the moment that sensation, but that sensation itself has become a trigger for all of that story. So let's, for a moment, just take away the story and know that you are laying in bed as a human being, feeling an uncomfortable sensation and feeling lonely. That deserves so much compassion in that moment that, oh, I don't feel good. That's not a nice thing for me to feel. I feel lonely. That's not a nice thing for me to feel. What can I give myself right now to help myself? How can I show up for myself right now? Because just there's something really vile we do to ourselves where we you know, you feel lonely and then you shame yourself. And tell yourself, like, it's like you pile on in that moment. If a bee came in and stung me right now, I wouldn't have a story about it. It would just suck. It would hurt. Yeah. It would hurt. That's real. It stung me and this hurts. But it wouldn't come with this giant story, like, of how I'm such an idiot. And I left the door open. I always make mistakes like that in my life. And here I am. Like, it wouldn't come with all the story. It would just be a bee stung me. That, oh, that sucks. I'm like, that sucks for me that a bee stung me. Oh, so annoying. It, we don't, we can give each, we can give ourselves that, that moment of compassion. And we can learn to treat the sensation instead of allowing ourselves to go down that road with that story that keeps taking us back over and over and over again to a bigger thing. And by the way, that story is the, it's the catastrophic thinking. It's the, I can never have a sip of wine again or eat those foods because of this pain, and how that's going to make my entire life boring. And that's the story. That's the catastrophic thinking. The truth is, for this woman that came to me, we don't know where your life is going to be a year from now. Mm. We have no idea. This story is telling you that you know all these things that you don't know. You don't know where you're going to be. Your past absolutely doesn't have to equal your future in this area. If you even start to do some subtly different things, you're going to get different results. Whether they're the exact result you want or not, it kind of doesn't matter. That anything can happen. Mm-hmm. Like if you do something a bit different, someone could come into your life or whatever, but even that doesn't matter, because actually what we're going to learn to do is be happy enough now with life the way it is. Mm. So that you know how to treat the sensation when it comes up. Because this is, we often measure the impact something is going to have on our life by the peak moments of pain. Mm. So when you're laying in bed and you're lonely at a 9 out of 10, we're not thinking about tomorrow morning when we might be at a 4.
Yeah, that's true.
And when you're at a 4, your life's completely different. You approach life completely differently. You have a completely different amount of power. You know, we forget sometimes that there's a whole hour. I've spent time with this woman, and I know for a fact there are entire hours we've spent together where she's just in joy and she doesn't think about that at all. And when you get an hour where I would think about this with my pain. If I got an hour where I didn't think about it, I'd go, that was the bit of daylight I needed. Because I went, if I can have 1 hour where I don't think about this, then I kind of have a new mission. Like, how do I make more of those? Like, if I can do it for 1 hour, maybe I can find 2 hours in a day where I don't think about this. What was the recipe? What was the formula? How did I get there? And in the times where it does feel like a 9 out of 10, my ability to bring it down to a 4, or the times where I didn't feel it at all, they became this kind of like these reference points for the fact that, okay, I don't need to freak out here. Like, it's not going to stay at this level. I don't need to freak out here. This pain is going to signal to me that it's all going wrong and everything's going to be bad. And that's the crescendo of overwhelm. I always think that anger, sadness, depression, anxiety, none of these things are dangerous emotions on their own. They become dangerous when they're combined with overwhelm. Mm. Overwhelm is the most dangerous emotion, because overwhelm is the crescendo of a negative emotion. And when you hit a crescendo, that's when you think your life is over. That's when you think you're never going to be happy again. That's when you do something to harm yourself. It's this crescendo of overwhelm that is really, really dangerous. So much of my work with people when it comes to pain is to get them to be like a boxer in the ring who is constantly slipping overwhelm, constantly just moving around, so that overwhelm never catches up to you. Because when you're not in overwhelm and you can get yourself to happy enough, your power comes back. You have the ability to create magic in your life. And that's what I helped her to find, is let's remove the story from this. Let's just acknowledge that you are a person who needs love in those moments where you feel lonely. That's the precise moment where you need to give yourself that love and that compassion and that kindness more than any other. And if you do that for yourself, you'll get to a point where you realize that you actually successfully can take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. And that idea that I'm going to die if I don't find this person, or if this doesn't happen, that idea starts to go away. Now, does that mean that there's no disappointments in life, or that there's not grieving that can take place in life? Or I think that's part of life, is that there are these inevitable disappointments in life, and life doesn't always happen the way that we want it to. And there are certain things we thought would happen by now that didn't. There are, you know, I deal with women all the time who find that their window has closed for having biological children, and they're grieving. They're in deep grief. But I'm a huge believer in the concept that we all had our plan A.
Yeah.
When plan A can't happen, how do you make plan B the new plan A? That's, to me, that's the real art of life, is how do you take plan B and make it the new plan A? And if plan B fails, how do you take plan C and make it the new plan A? Like, that's the artistry. It's the most, to me, that's the most creative act we can ever do, is take, say, with such resolution, I'm going to make plan B so beautiful that it actually would be hard for me to wish for plan A to have happened.
Because
it's so much has been created in plan B that I am so happy with, or just, it would be so hard for me to take all of that away now.
I think about how much suffering is created from trying to get back onto plan A, or
oh my God,
resist, you know, I forget which sage said it, but like trying, you know, resisting the life that's trying to flow through us, you know, and then so much suffering comes from this idea that I should have had a different past, or I should have had a different childhood, or I should have, but it's like, man, you know, what it sounds like you're really speaking to is this idea of one, like hyper presence, and really choosing our moments, our feelings, our perceptions, but also the recognition of impermanence. And like, as much as suffering in and of itself in a moment, you know, I think a lot about how we try to save other people from feelings we don't know the value of yet.
Oh, that's a good one.
You know what I mean?
I like that. Yeah.
And so when I think about like your wisdom about your greatest learnings coming from the things you didn't choose, I think like that, I experienced just emotion in thinking about like the most powerful transformations I've had in my life were ones exactly like I didn't have a choice in. And I never thought of it like the real gift was in the surrender to like trying to be like, well, this isn't part of who I was taught to be, how I was taught it was supposed to go. And I'm curious in your book and through your lived experience, what is it that you see is people's greatest challenge when it comes to finding the love of their life, when it, and getting to almost happy?
What's their biggest challenge in finding their person, in finding love, or what's their biggest challenge in being happy enough before they find their person?
How about all of that? Because it, and the correlation, like what do you see as the correlation of those?
Well, I think that a big part of happy enough is saying that actually, if my life stayed this way, that I would actually be okay. It may not be the, you know, it may not be the goal. I may want more out of my life, but if it stayed this way, I'd be all right. I think there's tremendous power to that. And it, when we're happy enough in that way, that's the power to take risks, because it's like true. When you have a home life that you like or love, it can make you more courageous in your business, because you're like, well, I can take this swing.
Yeah.
If it goes wrong, who cares? I'm fine. I'm already fine. This is not like, it's almost the opposite of the like Eminem 8 Mile thing. You know what I mean? Like, this is my one shot.
Yeah.
Like it's almost the opposite of that, where you go, it's not my one shot.
Yeah. Like, I got lots of shots.
Yeah. I'm fine. I'm going to go and swing for this.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because my life does not rest on whether this happens or doesn't happen. That is a powerful place to come from. I think rejection is far scarier when you've put the stakes of your happiness on it, when you, life depends on it. This is the one company I want to work for, and if I don't work for them, I'll never work for anybody. It's like, you well, of course you're going to find it impossible to be yourself in that interview. You know, this is my one shot at success. This is my one shot at love. This is
the one date, the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like this, I've never had a connection like this before. If I can't make it work with this person, I'll never find a connection like this again. Those are the kind of stakes that will make it impossible for you to show up authentically. And they're not true. They're just not true.
Right.
So the happy enough actually says, I'm all right. I'm all right. I can, like, that's where I got to with my pain, where I was like, I'm okay. If my pain never gets better than it is today, I've already found enough. I've found a level where if I had to operate here, all right, I could do this. Like, this is okay. Do I want my pain to go away? Yes. Could I operate here if I had to and still have a good life? Yes. That to me is real power.
Yeah.
And it also, happy enough allows you to say, especially in your love life, it allows you to say no too. You say no to the wrong person. You say no to the wrong opportunity. You say no to someone who's not treating you well, no matter how charismatic or sexy or, you know, eligible they seem. You can say, this isn't for me. This is your energy, your character, what you're showing me, the level of investment you're putting in. It's not for me. It's not right for me. It's not enough for me. When you're not happy enough, you are in need of a lifeline. You'll take anything because you go, I need something to save me from this. But when you're happy enough, you can choose. And there's just so much power in that. That to me is that's what allows you to show up to, you know, in the journey to find love. Because by the way, you can be happy enough and still admit that if you found the love of your life, you might be happier. The two aren't mutually exclusive. Yeah. I think we play these really disingenuous games in, like, whenever people talk about love, about, like, you have to be happy and healed first. Well, give me someone who was blissfully happy and healed in every way before they found their relationship.
Right.
Almost everyone I know, well, certainly everyone I know brought baggage to their relationship.
Yeah.
They brought something. And maybe they got rid of some of their baggage, but they didn't get rid of all of their baggage. Like,
no.
Everyone brings stuff to a relationship. So it's disingenuous, I think, when people say, you know, you have to be whole first. You have to be happy. No, you don't have to be happy and whole. You have to be happy enough. Because if you're happy enough, you will be able to choose. You know, okay, maybe if I found my life partner, is there a level of happy that I feel with Audrey in my life that I couldn't experience or didn't experience without her in my life? Of course, it would be such nonsense for me to claim otherwise.
Yeah.
But that doesn't stop you from being happy enough without that. And being happy enough without that might, when, by the way, I want to remind everyone listening, happy enough is achievable. That's what I like about it. It's achievable. And when you're there, it might end up being the reason that you do find love, because there's a different energy you can bring to the table. Right now I am releasing this book, and there's a lot of pressure, and, you know, I want it to be a big success, and I want lots and lots and lots of people to read it. And that whole process can be an incredibly anxiety inducing one. But I still know underneath it all, I'm okay. Like, I'm already happy enough. Like, it will be really great. I'm working hard to make it, you know, this giant success, but I'm okay. Like, this is not the thing that my happiness depends on. And there's something about that that allows me to show up to a conversation like this just entirely as myself, not as anything else. And that's such a freeing thing. And that's what I want this book to do for people who go out and date. I want someone to be sat on a date feeling like they're able to manage this, the frontier between showing up on the date as my best self and wanting to be great on a date, and also being able to do that in a very relaxed way, because you also know you're okay. You care. It's not, you don't go on a date with indifference. That's a different thing. Pretending
you don't care. That'd be a lie anyway.
It'd be a lie, and it's just another form of avoidance and a barrier, but you care. But you're also okay. I think that's the interplay between those two things.
Yeah, well, being that we're launching a book, I've never launched one before, so I really resonate with what you're saying. Like, I feel the immense pressure. I feel the, like, anxiety, like, how's it going to do? There's so much uncertainty. But also recognizing that, you know, I remember hearing that saying that the victory isn't in the outcome, it's in the process. Mm. And I'm learning a lot in this process. Yeah. I mean, I'm in a world I'd never been in before, the literary world. But also, when I think of that correlation back to relationship of like, when you come from a state of happy enough that there is, when you're going on the date or doing the thing, you know that your well-being or your sense of self is not on the line. Mm. And like, what a different energy to bring to a date than I need you to choose me or text me back, because if you do that, then I'm good. But if you don't, then I'm not.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure you've dealt with that the majority of your career, this sort For of sure. that dynamic. And I was hearing you talk about four levels.
Uh-huh.
And is it four levels of relating, or like, how
it's
do
like
you...
four levels of importance in any situation or
it's
any
good.
Relationship.
I was like, damn, I got to get you to talk about that.
Well, it's really important to me because there's I think it's chapter two in the book is called How to Tell Love Stories. And the reason I wrote that chapter was because I think we tell ourselves a lot of false love stories by overvaluing the wrong stages and the wrong things. And it gets us really, really hurt. So I said, okay, we need a model that helps us understand what's valuable and what's not, and appropriately evaluate things. So these are the four levels of importance for any situation you have with another person. The first level is admiration. And that's just you thinking someone's great in some way. You might think they're eligible. You might think they're smart. You might think they're attractive. You might think they're charismatic and sexy. They may not even know you exist, but you feel some kind of one-sided admiration for them. It goes without saying that, well, it should go without saying, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's not very important because it's not even in relation to another person. It's where unrequited love is born out of, which is something literature has romanticized and poetry has romanticized, but is completely just not important. It's so not important.
So painful.
So painful, and it's not, you can't be in love at someone.
You're right.
You know what I mean? There's an exchange that has to take place. So you admiring someone is just it becomes a form of worship if you're not careful. It's not happening in relation to, so not important. Level two is mutual attraction. It's where there's some kind of chemistry, connection. It might be a physical connection. It might be a mental connection. But there's some kind of exchange of feelings. And this is usually the most dangerous phase, because it can feel hard to meet someone we like. It can feel even harder to meet someone we like who likes us back.
Mm.
So when someone we like gives us some attention, it's like, that's like lightning in a bottle. That feels like
that's a drug.
The holy grail. Oh my God, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. It's also the most dangerous phase because it is the time where we're most likely to give up any standards we have. When we like someone, that's when we start to say, maybe I won't have that standard around my time or my energy or how much I give.
Inconvenient standard right now.
Exactly. That's really good.
I've done that. So,
it's an inconvenient. That's very good. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's not, this standard doesn't serve the thing I want.
Yeah.
I'm just going to keep trying, you know, and it's very easy to have standards with people you don't like that much. But when you have someone you really like, then all your standards go out the window. So mutual attraction is level two. But why isn't it that important? Well, because level three is where someone really puts their money where their mouth is with mutual attraction. That's commitment. Are we actually saying yes? Saying yes to a relationship, saying yes to building something, saying yes to exclusivity, saying yes to a future. Are we saying yes to each other? It is astounding how many people value level two so much and don't pay attention to the fact that the person isn't saying yes. And it feels, we'll write entire love novels for ourselves around what a person in our life should be, around the fact that they are the one that I've never felt this way. This is so special. I've never had this feeling before. Oh my God, the connection we have. Well, I had someone recently say to me, Matt, what do you do if you have the most epic connection with someone on a date and then they disappear? Well, this is in a way, this couldn't be less important, right? Mm-hmm. And it sounds ruthless, but how epic could the connection be?
Right. One way it was epic. There was one direction.
There was an epic kind of feeling that was produced on the date, and it certainly made a huge impact on you. But a relationship is so much more than an impact.
Right.
It's investment. It's two people who are committed to a vision together. It's so much more than that. So in order for something to actually be something, someone has to say yes. That's level three. And what I have tried my best to do in the last, 10 years of my life is to get people who are spending too much time grieving about level two to change the nature of their grieving. In other words, if someone says they don't want you, or they're not ready for a relationship, or they disappear, or they ghost you despite an amazing connection you had with them, or however amazing the time you spent was, you have to stop grieving as though they were the one.
Yeah.
Because they weren't. You can grieve the disappointment that they didn't turn out to be the one. That's a very different kind of grieving. Grieving the disappointment is natural. But grieving, the chronic grieving that comes from still thinking they're the one, and that they're out there somewhere living their life and you're just not with them, that's a grieving that never ends.
Yeah.
So, and I don't believe anyone could be your person if they don't choose you. I think that is the greatest contradiction that could ever occur.
It so logically makes sense, but we end up in these circumstances.
We do.
And we'll spend our lives in those circumstances.
I will see it all the same time. And we have to, they become the kind of, I think of them as like the great unhatched eggs of our lives. We keep them warm and we nestle them, and it just feels good to have what could come out of this egg, when it hatches, or if it ever did hatch, oh my God, it would be amazing, wouldn't it? And it's easy. It's very safe to have an unhatched egg. You can stay in your room and nurture it and not go and live life, not be an active participant in your life. There's a bit of a, there's an avoidance even in that. Because
there's a benefit to it,
There's a benefit to it. Yeah, it's safe. It's safe to think about. There's a show on Netflix right now called One Day. I won't ruin any, no spoilers. But
I've seen the trailer.
Yeah, and it's a good show. I mean, it's a great show.
I've heard it's heartbreaking, though.
Yeah, it is. It is. But me and my wife watched it together, and we loved the show. But I simultaneously was watching this show saying, these kinds of stories are why people have these unhatched eggs in their lives. Because, again, no spoilers, but there's a continuation of these two people's story that met in college. And they are friends. And there's this constant, are they going to? Are they not going to? And I can't... I just think in real life, I've watched the woman in that story or the man in that story spend decades not living their life, not being active and involved in the reality of their life, because they're nesting this egg that never hatches. In movies and TV shows and literature, these insane bets that people make often pay off with the person getting everything they ever wanted.
Right.
But in real life, bad bets are just bad bets. If you wouldn't take your life savings and put it on a 1 in 1,000 chance. But we do that with love all the time. Where we take our life savings, right? You're never going to get your time back. We take a decade of our life, 2 decades, 3 decades. I've seen some people do it with their whole lives. And we go all in on a 1 in 1,000 roulette wheel spin. And it's because the fantasy of the possibility of it happening is really powerful. And the feeling of a connection feels like that's the be all end all. I mean, Titanic is like an interesting movie, right? Because I love that movie. I'm not knocking the movie. I absolutely love it. I will cry every single time I watch Titanic. But there is, if you really stand back, there is something that feels a little strange about a woman circa 100 years old who is still kind of deeply connected and engrossed with this story about a guy that she spent, what, 5 days on a boat with? Like, this is not... She was married after that.
Right.
The poor husband.
Yeah. He's like, that's a famous movie now. It sucks. Yeah.
The idea that, like, the husband spent the life with her.
Oh, man.
But the guy she met on the boat, that was the love story? Like, this is why I say, how do we tell love stories? Because to me, a relationship is so much more than a connection. A relationship is two people who commit to something. So the third level is commitment, and the fourth level is compatibility. Are the two of you actually compatible? Do you work together? You're not just saying yes to a relationship. Does it work? Are you actually functional? Do you share the same moral compass? Do you have worldviews that are compatible? Do you share the same vision for what you want to build or create in your life? Does one of you want to have kids and the other one's like, no way? Is the timing of your life in sync? Or are you 20 years apart and want completely different things? Compatibility is so much more than we understand each other or we share some values. It's the total compatibility of your worlds, your minds, and your values. So when you look at life like that, you start to get out of this sense of, you know, even right person, wrong time. Oh God, it was right person, wrong time. What does that even really mean? It's like science fiction.
It just creates more pain too when I think about that saying.
It's another way to hold on to a love story. Yeah. But it's right, you know, if only they had been 5 years older. What parallel universe is this where they're
right.
They're 5 years older? It's not, like it's science fiction.
It's so true. Like if only they weren't going through a divorce. But they are.
Yeah, in this universe.
Yeah. This timeline.
They're 35, yeah. And this is where they're at.
Yeah.
They're 23, and they're nowhere near the same stage as you. They're like, it's like if they were just one, like, degree to the left. But so you mean just different genes?
Right. Different life.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, a different sperm hit the egg at a different time. Like, it's, we think that we're a few degrees off when, in fact, we're wishing for a parallel universe to exist. And I think it's really important because I'm not devaluing what people feel when they feel something for someone. That is real. It's real. But if we have to start defining what it is we are actually looking for, if we're truly looking for someone to build a life with, then we need to get honest about that. Because when you say, this is what I'm doing, I'm building a life, I want to find someone to build a life with, then you start looking for not just mutual attraction, you start looking for commitment, and you start looking for genuine compatibility on all of those things. Not, oh, I got 2 out of 4, so I'll keep going for the next 5 years until I realize it doesn't work, and then have the worst heartbreak of my life because I ignored it in the beginning, which is what we've all done it.
Right, yeah.
We've all done it. I've done it. It's excruciating. We create some of the biggest heartbreaks of our life in doing that. But I believe the more people are truly connected to the path that they want to be on, that's important to them, the more they get good at saying no to even the most attractive things that just don't fall on that path. And that takes character.
Yeah, that takes courage for sure.
Yeah.
To say, like, I'm willing to be so aligned with this desire that I'm willing to let go of what is almost it. I mean, some people spend their whole lives with an almost. And I think that ends up leading to the greatest pains, you know, the greatest sufferings.
Yeah, and I think a huge amount of this originates from us not having the hard conversation with ourselves first.
Hmm.
That I need to have a really honest conversation with myself that says, this is, you know, if you, for example, if you know children is something that is like 100%, that's what you want. You have to get really honest with yourself about that. So that if someone comes along and, you know, let's say you have a 5-year window and someone comes along and they're like, not even close. They don't even know if they want kids. They certainly don't want them in the next 5 years. It doesn't matter what you feel with that person. You go, I've already had the hard conversation with myself about how badly I want this. Nothing can deter me from this because I know it's a life dream of mine to make this happen. So we allow people to take us away from our path because we've never gotten really serious with ourselves about how important something is. And when you haven't defined what's important, you'll just gravitate to what feels comfortable in the moment. Mm. And what feels comfortable in the moment will often be really bad for you long term.
It's a painful lesson. I'm curious, how has your relationship with your wife informed the book?
Oh my God, in so many ways. I mean, she's taught me so much. She's also got an amazing mind for actually helping people, and she brought so many of her own ideas to the table, so that's changed so much. She's been responsible for me accepting myself on a whole different level, and me applying a much more compassionate lens to myself, because that's, you know, so much of the way with her, whenever I've been vulnerable, it's been repaid with acceptance and love. And that has made me a more vulnerable person out there with everybody else. So the comments under my videos now, when I mention Audrey or I mention the impact Audrey has had on me, is always like, I've noticed your content change
as
a result in the last few years. But it's had a massive impact, because I found the healthiest love that I've ever experienced, and it's hard not to want that for other people, you know, and to see my own journey of going from a much more sort of chaotic and roller coaster version of my own love life to, oh, this is the kind of peace that I want. This is the kind of happiness I want. This is a real relationship. That's changed so much about how I approach things. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I acknowledge you for the courage of walking that path, but also allowing people a window into like what you normally had kept private, that actually you're teaching through the openness in this book. And I can imagine that must feel beautiful, but also vulnerable. And I don't know if the right term, but it's almost like a coming home or a surrendering into, because the line between like your privacy and your teaching has now started to be less. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say. And I think I've got to figure out that balance. You know, I'd be interested to hear. I know that I'm going to interview you for my podcast, and I'd be interested to hear how you've navigated that.
I went the way other way. Like, I sobbed after our breakup on a podcast. So like, yeah, I think I had to start to preserve more privacy in some ways.
Yeah. I feel like I'm having a lot of, it's a weird time right now because a lot of the media around me and the book all lands in 1-2 week period. And so
right.
There's a sense in which I feel this like truly a low level hum of anxiety of, you know, I'm going to be really naked in April.
Yeah.
And, I can't say I'm like 100% comfortable. I'm not. I'm really comfortable. I feel really comfortable in myself right now. But I also feel, you know, when I share things with people in my life, I'm sharing them because I trust that person.
Yeah.
And there's a safety there in that relationship. Whereas in sharing things with the wider world, it's like you're sharing things with people that don't all have your best interests in mind. And you can't just trust everyone. And so it feels, I think I just feel a bit, that's just a bit scary for me is, yeah, trusting the world with parts of me that, you know, I would normally entrust to people that I know personally and I know love me.
Yeah, I think about it like having a window into a choice or an experience and then being able to filter someone's projection or their opinion of that is really healing codependency for me on like a meta level.
Mm.
Like, can I still, knowing that I'm in alignment with my own integrity and values, that I can be with what I know is true and they can have a projection or a thought or a perspective through their own lens. And I'm able to delineate my own value from that.
Mm.
And I remember Seth Godin was saying to me, there's a difference between valuable feedback and feedback, you know, like getting feedback from a good friend versus getting feedback from someone with a cat profile picture is such a different thing. But man, that's why I acknowledge you, because you're like walking this path of absolute openness of the teaching of the lessons of your life and the lessons of the things from teaching millions of people. Like, you have so many data points on human behavior that have also informed your own, like how you were saying, the shoes that you were growing into. It's like you're actually now growing out of those shoes and needing new ones.
That's a good way of
it's so beautiful. Like, yeah. I acknowledge you, man, like to witness your journey, but to have not known you personally and now to get the honor of this conversation and also your openness, like to welcome us into a world that you kept so private for so long and alchemized the learnings of. You needed to do that on your own. But then to bring it to us and be like, here's what I learned, it's such a gift. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. That means a tremendous amount to me. And maybe the next phase of it is to, you know, just learn, you know, as I now progress to learn with everybody. And I'm excited to be just in a very curious stage of my life where I feel, you know, I feel like I've shed that pressure to know it all. I think there's a lot of new things I'm learning and new ideas that are having an impact on me and areas where I'm just a very curious student. So I'm now, I don't know, it's more for, who did I hear? It may have been James Clear. He said something that it's it's a slightly off from what we're saying, but he was like, it's better to be a fan than a critic. Like, life is more fun when you're a fan.
Way more fun.
Yeah. And I think that I feel the way I feel is related to that, in that I feel like I'm just enjoying being a sponge and enjoying learning things and passing them on, and, you know, not being able to sit in front of people and just learn from them. I sat in front of David Kessler recently. I don't know if...
I met him last week at a conference.
Oh, you did? That's right. Yeah. Did you text me about that?
Yeah, you did.
Because
he was like, oh, you're interviewing him next week? Oh, we're dear friends. And
yeah.
I was like, ah, this world's too small.
No, it's crazy. And I sat in front of David and interviewed him for my audience in a series I was doing on Heartbreak. And I was not ready for what happened, because he started talking and I had just run from like three different meetings, and I sat in the chair and I was like, David, hi, all right, let's do this. And then he started talking, and something about the way he spoke, like, just broke through my defenses. Like, I was not prepared for it at all. And I just started welling up from the, this must have been 2 minutes into the session. I started welling up, and he looked at me and he was like, what? He clocked it. And David's not someone who just like moves on from things. And he was like, that right there is what you're feeling, is a little bit of unattended grief. Mm. And for those that don't know, David Kessler is a grief expert.
Jedi. Yeah.
Oh my God. And when he said that, it just broke me. It just broke me. And I had to find my way through this this conversation with him, where I was just on the verge of tears the whole time. And had that happened to me in a different time in my life, I would have truly not known what to do. And because it's happening now, it just felt like, all right, I guess this is where something's going on with me. And let's figure this out, and the audience is here, but they're doing their thing as well, and we'll just all do it together. And it's just so much fun. It's so much more fun that way, to just be on the journey with everybody. It's like giving new life to, I feel like, you know, when you get that feeling like, oh, I could do this forever if I'm just continuing to learn.
That's what it's like.
Yeah. If I just keep learning and we just keep growing together, and I could do that forever. That sounds great. So yeah, I feel like I'm in a new period of excitement and hunger for learning at this stage in my life. But I really appreciate you acknowledging me in that way.
Yeah. I mean, to live the questions is such a different, you know, like you said, your friend who's like, I know. And it's like, man, what a beautiful gift it is when we're like, I have an idea, or like, but I always think whenever I have certainty that the universe is going to humble me with a cosmic 2x4. And I've had enough of those that I'm like, can we have gentle lessons just for a bit? For everyone listening and watching, where can they find more of you, and where, more importantly, can they find the book? And I believe you also have an event that's going on for the book.
Yeah. So I don't know if people can just listen to me or they can see me right now, but I'm holding up the book. It's called Love Life: How to Raise Your Standards, Find Your Person, and Live Happily No Matter What. It's designed to be a co-pilot for anyone who's looking for love, and also to be there for you in the times where you don't have it, or where you've lost it, or where you're wondering if it's ever going to show up. There's a place that you can get the book anywhere that you get your books, but there's a cool thing. If you go to lovelifebook.com, you can buy the book through there from any retailer you want, but you can also use your receipt on that page to get access for free to an event I'm doing on May the 4th, which is virtual. So every book buyer is going to join us from all over the world simultaneously. Wow. And it's going to be a really, really special event. And the event's called Find Your Person. And the idea is to take all of the awareness, the epiphanies, the learnings from the book, and to give you an actual path to follow for the next year for finding your person. So I'm going to be live coaching people. My wife, Audrey, is going to be there as well. And if you haven't met her, you'll love her. People find her and then they're like, okay, I'll just follow her from now on. She's amazing. But we're going to be there together and it's going to be a really, really special event. So you can get the book and the event at lovelifebook.com.
Okay, perfect. We'll make sure we put those all.
And we have a podcast, Love Life with Matthew Hussey. If you want to come listen to me, we're about to record a show for Love Life. So I'm excited for people to listen to that. And I can't wait to ask you lots and lots of questions.
Man, I'm excited. And thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it. Well, I'm at your house, but so, you know.
Thank you for being here and having me on your podcast.
Perfect. Thanks, man.
All right, brother.